You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja.
We love the herb.
It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Thursday, and may the 4th be with you, 2017. It's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Welcome to the Marijuana Agenda. I'm Russ Belville, and coming up on today's show in the news from MarijuanaMoment.net's Cannabis Headline News, we find that Tom Marino will not be the next drug czar. We'll give you some details why. In our Police for Reform segment, Leap's Nick Morrow joins us to discuss his experience working in the L.A. County Sheriff's Department as part of the 1992 L.A. riots. Those are 25 years old. The Drug War Data Mining segment today, we take a look at Project Sam's ridiculous report they've released on the cost of marijuana legalization. In Cannabis Community Chat, we get you prepared for the Global Cannabis March this weekend. We speak with Dana Beal, the founder of the march, and Noah Potter, the organizer of the New York City episode of the march. And then coming up at the end of the show, we'll have time for a radical rant. I'll tell you how I'm heading off to Fort Worth for the Global Cannabis March and why you need to get your feet in the streets and stand up for the legalization of the adult use of marijuana. All voices matter. We need your voice out there in the streets, letting our elected officials know we're okay, we're good people, and we don't deserve to be treated like criminals. We got to take a break, but when we come back in less than 2 minutes, we've got your cannabis headline news. Stick around.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal potland Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House. Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb and licensed by the City of Portland.
Georgia.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. Alcohol prohibition didn't work in the 1920s, and marijuana prohibition isn't working today. It's time we stopped arresting responsible marijuana smokers. It's the fair thing to do.
For more information, contact NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Call toll-free 888-67-NORML or visit their website at norml.org.
The Marijuana Agenda. Kevin Sabet's Boogeyman since 2012.
You have offended my family, and you have offended Shaolin Temple.
Yes, might have gotten away with it too, if it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every Friday for the Reefer Rock Review with Herb Thrasher from 420radio.org. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
This is your cannabis headline news. Brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net. The complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Thursday, May 4th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. President Donald Trump will not appoint Representative Tom Marino to be the nation's drug czar, a White House official tells U.S. News. Pennsylvania Republican was widely expected to be named to lead the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. CBS News reported on April 11th that, according to multiple sources, Marino would be nominated to lead the office, a move that requires Senate confirmation. Marino was undergoing the final stages of completing his paperwork ahead of an official nomination, one source told CBS. Marino in a statement cited, quote, a critical illness in my family, end quote, as his reason for withdrawing, but numerous controversies, including a 1998 allegation that he helped a friend avoid a cocaine dealing charge through so-called judge shopping, may have had something to do with it. A spending package to fund the federal government through the end of the fiscal year passed through the House Wednesday. The $1.1 trillion omnibus spending bill includes the remaining 11 annual appropriation bills that will fund agencies and Congress for the rest of fiscal 2017, which ends on September 30th. The vote came 2 days before a funding deadline that would have shut down the government if the measure stalled any further. Included in the spending bill is the so-called Rohrabacher-Blumenauer Amendment that prevents the Department of Justice from spending taxpayer dollars to interfere in the lawful operation of commercial medical marijuana in the states that recognize legal medical use of cannabis. In the final days of the Vermont legislative session, a new compromise plan may finally result in the first state in the nation to legalize marijuana without a voter initiative. On one end of the legalization spectrum is the Senate's plan to have the state regulate marijuana. It includes retail stores and the taxation of pot, similar to the approach taken in Colorado. On the other end of the spectrum is the House plan to legalize the possession of 1 ounce of marijuana and allow individuals to grow a few plants. This is like the legalization law in Washington, D.C. The compromise incorporates the House approach and includes a special commission that would study how best to implement a state-regulated model. The panel would make its recommendations to lawmakers next January, and the proposal would be subject to legislative approval at that time. A Freedom of Information Act request by the New York Times has revealed that the experts chosen by the New York Department of Health to evaluate applications for just 20 statewide medical marijuana licenses had little to no experience with cannabis. The request for information was delayed 9 times by the department and finally rejected last Friday. On Monday, however, the department reversed course and revealed the names of the 17 evaluators, who are all state employees. The state's program has been criticized for a cumbersome and often opaque rollout, in part because of restrictions placed on the drug's medical use, for example. It cannot be smoked and must be used in forms like tinctures and oils. Critics have also faulted the state for seemingly opting to create a model from scratch, despite more than 20 other states having medical marijuana programs, an assertion the health department disputes, saying its panel, despite its lack of expertise in the field, drew from other states' experiences. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is being called a liar by one of his Democratic rivals after the mayor said at a campaign event last night that among the changes he implemented was, quote, ending arrest for low-level possession of marijuana, end quote. De Blasio made the remark during a candidate forum in Manhattan hosted by the Village Independent Democrats. Robert Ganji, a longtime prison and police reform activist, sent an email to supporters Wednesday morning titled De Blasio's Marijuana Lies and citing New York State statistics showing that during the first 3 months of 2017, NYPD made more than 5,000 arrests for the possession or sale of small amounts of marijuana. In South Africa, the National Director of Public Prosecutions and several other government departments have filed an appeal to the decision by the Western Cape High Court legalizing the personal use and cultivation of dacha, as cannabis is called there. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Thursday, May 4th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. Subscribe now to MarijuanaMoment.net, the only daily newsletter you need for cannabis news.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics. Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
It's time for Cannabis Facts About Alzheimer's from Robert Platschorn's thesilvertour.org. This message is supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com. A new Florida study in the journal Molecular and Cellular Neuroscience found that cannabis promotes the growth of healthy new brain tissue. It can slow the effects of Alzheimer's and may in fact be able to halt it entirely. A long-term study by Ohio State University's Professor Gary Wenk concludes that people who regularly use marijuana get Alzheimer's at a much lower rate than others. This was Cannabis Facts from the SilverTour.org, an educational nonprofit supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com.
The marijuana agenda, like the gay agenda, only with better music.
I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for Shark Sessions from The Marijuana Show. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
This is Police for Reform, brought to you by Law Enforcement Action Partnership at LEAP.cc. LEAP is a group of law enforcement professionals advocating for criminal justice reforms in the areas of drug prohibition, mass incarceration, asset forfeiture, community policing, and more. LEAP provides qualified speakers across the world to speak with authority on criminal justice issues. We visit with one such speaker now in Police for Reform.
Welcome to Police for Reform, the podcast of Law Enforcement Action Partnership. You can learn more at policeforreform.com. I'm Russ Belville, and on this podcast, we'll be visiting with various speakers from Law Enforcement Action Partnership, people who have spent their days in law enforcement through being police officers, being prison guards, being prosecuting attorneys, defense attorneys. All aspects are involved in Law Enforcement Action Partnership. And joining us today, we have former detective and deputy sheriff Nick Morrow from Seal Beach, California. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's interesting to speak to law enforcement people who have been working in California, being that's been the hotbed of so much activism in marijuana law reform and drug law reform in general. And I was wondering if you could just tell the listeners a little bit about your background. When did you get started in law enforcement?
I got hired by the LA County Sheriff's Department in 1983. And worked a variety of assignments there, including custody that, you know, all deputy sheriffs work, L.A. County deputy sheriffs go through. So I worked a custody assignment, patrol assignments. I worked detective assignments, station narcotics investigator, that type of thing. And then training assignments. I taught at the academy off and on subjects about, drug use, drug trafficking, that kind of thing. And so it's kind of a broad base. I had a lot of opportunities in my career. I got assigned. I worked in, sleepy little Catalina Island for a couple of years. And that assignment allowed me the access to training that most other deputy sheriffs don't get a chance to access till later on in their career. So I was very fortunate there. And just kind of, a well-rounded approach to law enforcement in general.
You were hired on by L.A. County in 1983. How long were you in law enforcement?
Just about 11 years. And so I retired in 1993, 1994 out of a due to a service-connected disability. I messed up my back during an arrest of a drunk. And a couple of years of trying rehab and all that kind of stuff led to a retirement from the Sheriff's Department.
Hmm. So given that time span, then you must have been involved with the L.A. County Sheriff's during the time of the Los Angeles riots. People are recognizing the 25th anniversary of that event. Can you give us your perspective, what it was like for law enforcement at that time and maybe how the war on drugs impacts this relationship between communities and the police?
Yeah, the relationship between the people that are being policed and the officers and deputy sheriffs that are doing the policing has always been it's always a contentious one at some level or another. You know, nobody likes to be looked after. Nobody likes to be, you know, called on their stuff, for lack of a better word. So you always have that tension that's there, you know, and it, and a lot of people try to explain it in a very simple fashion. And, you know, there's social issues, there's economic issues, there's, you know, there's racial issues, there's, you know, who deals with who and, you know, where they are. You know, there are a lot of issues that, that pop up into making that an incredibly complex thing to figure out. You know, as far as the riots were considered, you know, the tensions were on every aspect were high until, you know, the people that were being policed, the people that were being looked after by law enforcement. You know, there's that not guilty verdict, you know, that pops up at a time where the entire L.A. basin was a powder keg. And that's all it took to set it off. And if you go back into time, even further back, the Watts riots, you know, a minor incident set it off. And, you know, that's the type of thing. And then we try to blame it on one faction or another. You know, cops are bad. Gangsters were at the, you know, at the root of it. And, you know, we're playing the blame game on every one of these social issues. And when smarter people than both of us need to figure out what really, you know, what really produced the powder keg environment that existed, and it still exists. You know, we're, you know, like I said, with Ferguson and you know, other police-involved shootings, you know, we now have body cam footage that now everybody believes that they're there and they saw it and they know exactly what was going through the minds of the people that were there. But, you know, the body cams are, you know, they're just a tool. And so, you know, smarter people than us need to be able to interpret those and, you know, come to the conclusion of what the real issue is and what really happened on a lot of individual circumstances. So it's not going to get any easier anytime soon. And, you know, the access to the social media and everybody has a video camera in their hand now, you know, that's so, there's going to be less and less unknown about a lot of these incidences. So, you know, that it's cautious optimism on my part that, okay, great. We're going to change the way we work as police officers. And the public is going to change the way they interpret police officers, and maybe somehow we're going to come together in the middle someplace.
Yeah, I would say that there's a lot of parallel in that the Rodney King verdicts were spurned, you know, the riot spurned off of that was because of videotape that showed the actions of the officers in the beating. And now we have the Walter Scott case and other cases where we see video, and people oftentimes say that it's now only because the cameras are showing this, that it's happening, that anything is being done about it. In law enforcement, there seems to be a code of silence, or people, you know, closing ranks for their own rather than seeking out the justice that the people deserve in these sort of situations. In looking back to the 92 riots compared to what's going on today, what sort of reforms in policing have been attempted, are being attempted? What's going to make a difference in your view with your experience?
Well, all of this is an evolution. I worked in LA County Jail, the inmate reception center. So I was, you know, involved in you know, a lot of the people going back and forth to court, a lot of the housing issues, a lot of the segregation issues that were in there. And when I worked there, I believe the LA County Central Jail was designed for 5,000 or 6,000 inmates. And at the time there was I think the census was closer to 10,000. We had people jammed in a small space. We had people sleeping on mattresses and shower rooms and things like that. It was an incredibly violent place. And on one hand, it really had to be to maintain control over an incredibly crowded environment. You know, so there were fights every night. There were, you know, there was abuses that came up, you know, depending on what side of the fence you were on. And it was a very dangerous place for the officers that worked there. You know, so you had to be on your toes, you know, 24 hours a day kind of thing. But, you know, because of things that happened during that time, because of allegations, because of incidents, because of, you know, any one of a number of incidents, riots in the jail, that type of thing, you know, we moved towards having outside people look at that. And the Sheriff's Department, you know, there was, I think the Christopher Commission and the Colts Commission, they issued reports about how the jails were being run and how, you know, certain things that needed to be done. As a guy that was there at the time when all these things were happening, you know, I think I for in one part of my mind welcomed that scrutiny that, you know, we really needed, you know, those reforms needed to happen. And, you know, things have improved there since then, despite people wanting to discount the fact that things are just as bad as they've always been. They've improved because, you know, it was really bad. Now it's not as bad. This process still needs to keep going. So law enforcement needs to keep looking at themselves because, you know, plain and simple, we're given the constitutional ability to do a lot of stuff. And, you know, we have a lot more power than maybe the average person realizes. You know, how long does it take the state to put somebody to death? Probably a decade in most cases. How long does it take a deputy sheriff or a police officer on the street to decide whether or not he needs to shoot and kill somebody? Less than a second and a half. You know, so the people with that kind of power, that kind of responsibility, you know, on one hand, they need to be given a little bit of leeway to be human beings. And then on the other hand, they need to be really, really well trained and well disciplined to do their jobs without doing something, you know, incredibly tragic. And so, you know, it's a two-sided issue. You know, I've talked to a lot of people, you know, how do I deal with police officers in the field? I get that question a lot. And, you know, I keep telling them, I go, you know, there's a lot of really good things that a police officer does. And when I got the job, when I applied for, you know, the Sheriff's Department in LA, I was already an EMT. I worked in an ambulance crew. You know, I was interested in taking care of people. That was what I liked to do. I was impressed with law enforcement. I wanted to be a part of it. And when I got in there, I learned in the academy, you know, you learn first aid and CPR, you learn traffic safety, crime suppression, all the procedures for law enforcement, you know, I mean, everything under the sun to benefit your community. And so we're trained to do a ton of things that are beneficial to our community. But at the same time, we're also taught that there are people involved in your community that are looking for any reason to kill you. And cops don't wear bulletproof vests because we're afraid of each other. We wear bulletproof vests because we're afraid of you. We carry extra bullets and handcuffs and all that kind of stuff. And we take training in you know, defensive tactics and all that kind of stuff. And if you think about it from your perspective, all the things that I'm trained to do, you know, I've learned, I'm proficient with firearms and I have access to firearms and that kind of thing. If I looked you in the eye and told you I'm going to kill you, you have my face that you're going to recognize, and you're going to be afraid of me for what I'm capable of. And you have to be lucky every day of your life. I just have to be lucky once. And so if you think about it to yourself, how would you change the way that you deal? How would you change your life to deal with a threat like me? And, you know, I mean, the quick answer is, well, you know, you'd peek outside, you'd look around the corner and all that kind of stuff. So when you put the shoe on the other foot with me, I'm told that there's a portion of my community that doesn't like me, that was given an opportunity will kill me. You know, how do you end up changing your life to deal with that massive threat? You know, so it's, you know, like I said, if you have one person threatening you, you have one person to deal with. In my case, I have 1,000 out there that at any one given time, every car I walk up to might be the car. And so, you know, it's kind of like it's a two-way street. And what I'm getting at is the citizen on the street has to realize what the law enforcement officer is going through and what their responsibilities are. And the law enforcement officer has to realize exactly the opposite. So we're responsible for each other's safety. You know, as a driver on the street, if I get pulled over, it falls on me not to do anything stupid that's going to make that officer panic. And as an officer, you know, I'm not going to allow a person in a car who I don't know, who I've never met before, do something that may or may not result in me getting hurt. And so, you know, it's the responsibility falls on both of us. And that's just in an individual contact. And then when you start talking about, you know, citywide, countywide, statewide kind of policies, we all are responsible for making it as safe as it possibly can be for law enforcement to do their job, which is vitally important. You know, one of the questions I always ask is, you know, well, okay, if you're not going to call a cop, who are you going to call? Local gang member, meth dealer, you know, who's going to solve your problems for you? And so, you know, I never really get a good answer out of that one.
Well, Nick Morrow, we appreciate taking a nuanced look at all of these issues involving policing in the communities. And your experience is definitely useful in that discussion. We appreciate you joining us here on Police for Reform.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks a lot.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. Subscribe now for free at mjagenda.com.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
This is Cannabis Facts from Robert Platschorn's thesilvertour.org. Supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com. In 1937, the second most prescribed medicine, marijuana, was banned. It wasn't about marijuana. The paper, oil, and chemical industries lobbied to end hemp farming. No longer labor-intensive, an acre of hemp produced more quality paper than 4 acres of trees. Plastics and fibers could be produced from a plant. Hemp can even produce 10 times the energy of today's ethanol. As marijuana prohibition ends, many states now allow farmers to again grow hemp. This was Cannabis Facts from thesilvertour.org, an educational nonprofit supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to process America's hemp crop at hempinc.com.
The Marijuana Agenda, Kevin Sabet's boogeyman since 2012.
You have offended my family, and you have offended Shaolin Temple.
Yes, yeah, might have gotten away with it too. It wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for the UK Cannabis Chronicle from the UK Cannabis Social Clubs. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Promoting the end of adult cannabis prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It's even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more on this edition of Drug War Data Mining.
As you know, I've been following the Joker to my Batman, Kevin Sabet, for, going on 5 years now, as he tries to scare the hell out of America that is increasingly becoming really cool with marijuana legalization. And in the early days of his time with Project Sam, there was a talking point that he used all the time, and it was that for every $1 that alcohol and tobacco bring in taxes, they cost society $10 in social costs. So his point was that if you were to make an equation, then you could say that the cost of legal pot is equal to the tax of legal pot times 1,000%. That was his basic figure there. It'd cost us 1,000 times more than what we'd make in taxes. Now, you haven't heard him say this very much lately, because Colorado and Washington State and their initial tax revenues were showing $200 million in tax revenue from marijuana legalization. So the 1-to-10 ratio there means that Kevin Samet needed to come up with $2 billion in social costs from the use of marijuana in those two states. And he'd be hard pressed to do that. You've heard me talk about this a few times, and I've always made the joke that, look, I'll give you a push. Show me an equal amount of social cost that has occurred from marijuana legalization. Well, maybe Kevin's been listening to me because he has come up with a new report. This is on the Project Sam website. You can find it if you can stomach it. It's at learnaboutsam.org/costs. And the heading here reads, even a conservative estimate of a few projected economic and social costs of marijuana legalization in one state, Rhode Island, totaled $61.2 million for 2020, exceeding the revenues projected by pro-legalization activists by over 25%. Oh, no. Okay, so first of all, it's Rhode Island, little tiny state, you know, 50 miles wide. So I don't know how well you can extrapolate Rhode Island, which is a mostly urban little tiny state, to how legalization would proceed in any other state. But first of all, let's take it at its face value. Let's suppose that this were all absolutely true. So the figure they give here for the different costs, the projected annual costs, totaled up 119.1% of the revenues that were projected by pro-legalization activists. So not 1,000%, 119%, 19% more cost than tax revenue brought in. Okay, that's if you take this at face value. That's if you believe Kevin Samet when he tells you there's all of these terrible outcomes from marijuana legalization. So let's get to what the costs are that they're claiming. They're claiming there's administrative and enforcement costs totaling $4.6 million, and that would make up 9.5% of the revenue projected by the people wanting to legalize in Rhode Island. Fair enough, there are regulatory costs. You have to have inspection and testing and labeling and all this kind of stuff. Yes, there are regulatory costs, but less than 10% for regulation. Then he adds, increased drugged driving fatalities costing $13.2 million or 27.3% of the tax revenues. Hold the phone. Increased drugged driving fatalities. Now, this is backed up by their little dubious statistic that says, well, since we legalized in this state, we take a look at all the people who died in traffic fatalities, and my God, there's so many more of them that have marijuana metabolites in their system. Well, yeah, marijuana's legal, and now they can use it more often, and it's legal to do so. It's more likely that that window of time, that 30-day period in which someone could use marijuana, is likely to be tripped. It's likely to happen now, likelier to happen now that marijuana is legal. It's just as relevant to tell me you're finding more married gay men in car crashes these days. Yeah, because it's legal to be a married gay man. When they cover these stats, always remember they're talking, when they say a marijuana-involved auto fatality, they're saying someone's dead, we found marijuana in their system. It doesn't say that that person was high at the time. It doesn't say that their being high at the time had anything to do with the accident. They might have been high as hell, but driving perfectly safe and got T-boned by somebody else, by a drunk driver maybe. That would be considered a marijuana-related fatality for these statistics. So you can't throw in the $13.2 million there. He adds in a figure here, making up 28.4%, the second highest total of the projected income from marijuana tax revenues, to increased homelessness. Yeah, increased homelessness. If you legalize marijuana, all of a sudden there's homelessness. And for his statistic, he cites the Colorado and Denver homelessness counts that they've had since marijuana legalization has happened. Now, this is one of those things that's true. Yes, there have been increases in the homeless population, but it is out of context. The fact that there's more homeless people owes a lot to the fact that Denver and Colorado in general, since legalization, has had an economic boom. And there's been a massive increase in housing prices, the same we've seen here in Portland, the same they've seen in Seattle, because of that economic boom. Those increases in the housing prices and the lack of affordable housing is what leads to more homelessness. People coming from out of state trying to get jobs in this new economy that don't have housing when they first get there. That leads to the increases in homelessness. So you can't tout that as a cost of legalization. That's a cost of just an economy rising from finally having a job base and getting some tax revenue and putting some money into the hands of the people. I guess we got to keep pot illegal so there won't be more jobs and more tax revenue. He adds the increased ER visits. Again, the ER visits being related to marijuana are like the traffic accidents. It's we found someone in the ER that had pot in their system, or they admit they smoke pot, or we found pot on them. Doesn't mean it had anything to do with them being sick or the marijuana causing their accident or their illness. He also adds in workplace, lost productivity, and more accidents, which again are dubious statistics at best that are oftentimes owed to the confounding factor that when marijuana is illegal, people won't admit that it was marijuana that caused their problem. Now that marijuana is legal, more people are willing to admit it, and that's why you're seeing some of these statistical rates increase.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is proudly sponsored by the Marijuana Business Association. The MJBA, called by NBC News the Cannabis Chamber of Commerce, is the fastest growing business association and the fastest growing industry in America. I've been working with the MJBA for years, and I personally invite you to join the MJBA. MJBA also publishes the popular MJ Headline News on Facebook and the MJNewsNetwork.com and Marijuana Channel 1 on YouTube. Visit MJBA.net for more details.
It's time for Cannabis Facts about Teen Drug Use from Robert Platschorn's thesilvertour.org. This message is supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com. A recent survey by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control indicates that in states that have legalized medical marijuana, the rate of marijuana consumption among high school students has not increased. In fact, in legal states like Colorado, teen use has actually decreased significantly. It's simply no longer a big deal for teenagers in legal states. This was Cannabis Facts from thesilvertour.org, an educational nonprofit supported by our donors and Hemp Inc., a public company poised to lead America's hemp revolution at hempinc.com.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
It's like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking.
Learn more at mjagenda.com.
I'm Russ Belville with The Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for Veterans of Compassion with the Veterans Cannabis Group. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
The cannabis community is a diverse set of people from all walks of life, conservative and liberal, black and white, straight and gay, rich and poor, and everyone in between. Learn more about the people we are freeing from adult cannabis prohibition in our Cannabis Community Chat.
Coming up this weekend is the latest iteration of the Global Cannabis March. This has been taking place for years all around the world. Over 300 cities at some count have been taking part, and of course, one of the biggest cities to be taking part is the Big Apple, New York City. And joining us to discuss this weekend's march is Noah Potter. Noah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Russ. Thanks very much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the genesis of this march. How did it come about?
Okay. Well, actually, the New York event goes back to the early 70s. It's an outgrowth of the Youth International Party, the Yippies, strong new left countercultural movement, and it's part of the same generation as the New York classics, the Pride Parade, the Halloween Parade. It's really an original, authentic part of the New York, old New York culture. It's also now a global event. In 1999, it evolved into the Global Marijuana March, and indeed takes place in hundreds of cities around the world. If you take a look at the video online, if you go to our website, cannabisparade.org, and you click on the video at the bottom of the homepage, you can see the size of the crowds. I mean, there's got to be hundreds of thousands of people around the world taking part in this event. For example, in Buenos Aires, in Rio, in Cape Town, numerous European cities. The events in Colombia are huge. And they all grew out of this event, which I like to call our event, we're the founding chapter of the Global Marijuana March. And it actually, you may know a well-known personality, that being Dana Beal, is the founder of this event. He's been involved for decades. Came a point about 2011, which I stepped in to do some general management. He had taken a bit of an extended leave of absence in some correctional facilities in the Midwest, and I had to step in and keep it going, keep the tradition alive.
That's, of course, Dana Beal is a longtime activist, and we hope to be speaking to him about the event as well. Let's talk about the event itself taking place this Saturday, along with, you know, so many other cities around the world. What are the details people need to know about this march coming up?
Okay, so there's two parts to the event. It's a parade that proceeds to a public park in which we have a sound stage with speakers and music. So the parade assembly point is West 31st and Broadway. There'll be a small soundstage set up. We're going to have a speak out with political speakers and activists. The parade will, and that's at 11 a.m., the parade will step off at 12:30 and head down Broadway to Union Square, which is a located park in around 14th Street. A lot of things happening there, lots of street traffic. Lots of subway lines come together. It's really a perfect location. The show will begin at 1. We have sound permit until 5. We're going to have musical acts. We're going to have some speakers. I'm very, very, very happy to say that the direction which we've taken the parade has engaged with elected officials. And so this year we have participation from 3 elected officials. We have City Council Member Rafael Espinal from Bushwick, who's going to be speaking for the third year. We have the participation of State Assembly Member Richard Gottfried, which is really just overwhelming. Assembly Member Gottfried is the grandfather, or the godfather, as you wish, of cannabis legalization in New York State. He brought about decriminalization in the late 70s in his very first term as Assembly Member when he was in his 20s. He's been a champion in pushing the medical statute, and he had a great bill until the governor trashed it in 2014, and he's been pushing for the full legalization bill that's pending in Albany now. So we're very happy to have him. We're also going to be hosting, I believe, a representative of State Senator Jesse Hamilton. And Jesse Hamilton, my representative actually here in Brooklyn, is one of the co-sponsors, I believe, of that full legalization bill that's pending in Albany, the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act. Joined by numerous other activists, Empire State Normal, then veterans groups, and so on. We have a pretty good lineup of speakers. I have a good lineup of music. I believe we may be having some surprise guests, but people are going to have to stay tuned for that on our Facebook page.
All right. Well, let's get to that so people can find that information. What is the Facebook page or any other information people need to know to find you online?
Okay. So our website is cannabisparade.org. And our Facebook page is NYC Cannabis Parade, the founding chapter of the Global Marijuana March.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. And it's also excellent to hear so many of these elected officials that will be showing up to speak. I'm also curious about what is the atmosphere at these marches lately, as far as police presence or intimidation by police, cooperation from police, and do you anticipate any changes now that there's been a kind of a sea change in America?
Yeah, well, let me say first, our relationship with NYPD, I think, has been really, really quite good. At least, when I was involved in the mid-90s for briefly, and then got back in year out in 2011. And there were some really rough patches in the history of the event in the previous years. There were times when there were really many, many arrests. I mean, I've heard it's up into the three figures. I believe that largely coincided with the Giuliani administration. Rudolph Giuliani, so many of you might know, is America's mayor, is also a staunch opposition of progressive drug policy. There have been actually no arrests, to my knowledge, for at least the past 3 years. There was an arrest in 2013, I believe, which was conducted by an undercover narcotics officer entrapping someone into purchasing and then promptly arresting that person. And I was told, and this is like, you know, double hearsay, that one of the officers, on commanding officers, actually apologized to one of our MCs, saying that nobody had told him that the narcotics squad was sending somebody. But I've had very, very cordial relations with NYPD. I like to think that they appreciate that we're very earnest about maintaining public order, being respectful of the space. And they generally give, I have the understanding that they kind of like us. We don't cause trouble. We don't have fights. I mean, when there's problems, they come from alcohol users. And that's not to say that everybody's a fan of cannabis is necessarily on a peaceful vibe, but generally we don't cause trouble. So we've had very positive relations. I'm very appreciative of the assistance of NYPD. In fact, NYPD offered us the use of Broadway, which was a couple of years ago, which was just, I mean, who can say no to Broadway? In terms of new environment, you know, you never know. There's no guarantee. People say, hey, so I can smoke weed. And we say, no, nobody said you can smoke weed. It's, you know, we can't guarantee you anything. We come out for our event, as we do every year. There's a new police commissioner. I have not, you know, this would be the first time. I don't anticipate any issues. There's nothing that gives me the impression that he's that cannabis prohibition is important to him, or, well, I shouldn't say it's not important to him, but it's not a priority. It's not a priority to harass peaceful cannabis users. In terms of the federal situation, now, that's anybody's guess. I'd like to think that there's sufficient opposition to the Trump administration in the city government and among the local electeds that nobody's going to be getting any special credit at the local level for getting tough on cannabis. And you never know, but I don't have reason to think that federal law enforcement is going to be egging on NYPD to take action, or even to take action themselves. Frankly, I don't know how they would do that. But, you know, so you never know, but there's no storm clouds on the horizon here, except the actual storm clouds. And if everybody could put in a good word with their preferred celestial being or non-beings, as the case might be, to hold back the rain, that would be appreciated.
Yes.
But, you know, on the human political side, it's looking okay.
All right. Well, good luck for this march taking place on Saturday, gathering at high noon. Is that correct?
Well, we do say high noon, and that's when people show up. We've actually called the assembly a little bit earlier this year, 11 a.m., West 31st and Broadway, stepping off at 12:30. People who are coming are welcome to bring costumes. They're welcome to bring acoustic instruments, because we don't have a sound permit for the march. So, but acoustic instruments, signs, positive signs supporting legalization or some minimum form of rational drug policy, and so on, you know, all welcome.
All right, looking forward to it. I got my start in activism going to My City's Cannabis March, and you can do the same thing. It's where you meet the people that are going to make the difference. Noah, thanks for joining us here on the show, and good luck again this weekend. Best of weather to you.
Thanks. Thank you, Russ. Thanks.
Global Cannabis March is taking place this weekend, and if you're heading out to your city to take part in the march, you have someone to thank for that. And joining us today on the telephone is Dana Beal, who was the founder of the Global Cannabis March. Dana, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
So, Dana, tell us about the founding of the march. How did this start, and how are things different now than compared to when you first started the march?
Well, you know, the reason that we have it on the first Saturday of May is actually just weather. Even now, the weather is tricky, but it's like less of days of rain. You know what I'm saying? Very hard to have a cheerful marijuana march in a downpour.
Yeah, no kidding.
So usually about the beginning of May is about the first time you can do it in New York. And it caught on around the world thanks to Rudolph Giuliani, who tried to ban the annual pot parade in its 26th year. Instead, it boomeranged because we went on the internet and organized a worldwide march on that day to point up the grievous violation of civil rights occurring by people simply trying to ban a parade based on its content, based on what the message being wrong, right? Now you may see that Giuliani is in trouble for leaks from the FBI. Maybe he'll go to jail with the rest of the Trump clan.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? So you started the march. What was the year of the first march?
Well, the first guy to do it was a guy named Rex Weiner. He did it in 72. I was in jail, so I couldn't be there. The next year we did it, and it turned out to be quite big. It was, we were a little surprised at how successful it was.
And in these early marches, did you have
people?
How many people?
A few thousand, you know, right in the first year. They're going to be having a memorial to David Thiel on Saturday. Steve Hager and Steve Bloom are doing some stuff with music. And
so in the
old, like regime, the old guard, has lost a lot of people. Dennis Perrone right now is on his last in hospital. He's in very bad shape, and he will probably not live another week.
That's a shame to hear.
It's good that I feel great. I mean, I had a heart attack, and I died on the jailhouse floor, and then was revived, and I got out, and I completely quit alcohol, and I just smoked pot.
Well, good for you, man.
Our message is that it's so much safer than alcohol and tobacco. It's not only good for people who are gravely ill. There's a public health imperative. All those people in Europe, I'm going to the ENCOD conference in Barcelona, the European Coalition, they kind of quit smoking tobacco with their marijuana, man. It's bad. Hmm. Really bad. That will give you cancer.
Yeah, I heard that tobacco stuff's bad for you.
Yeah, and like pot will block cancer, you know? It's just a pharmacological happenstance. But
so, Dana, coming up for the march on Saturday in New York, you were telling me earlier about the giant joint. Is that now a part
of
the march?
Yeah, we've got it back. This is the joint that shadowed Hillary Clinton on her campaign. We were outside the Wall Street speech, or was she talked about a basket of deplorables.
Oh, really?
If they'd been talking to the pot people instead of chasing us off, we could have told them, all you have to do is do a big press conference in Florida announcing you're endorsing the initiative and that you're for medical marijuana. You'll work out the details later, but you care about patients. That's what people want to hear. She would have won the election.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. You know, that they're like they were seriously off-putting to a lot of people. Was a certain point, people were making up their mind, you know, and I guess these are the kind of people who ended up voting for Gary Johnson, right? Because Chelsea released some kind of statement about reports of drug interactions from coroners in Colorado, like, you know, the pot could be dangerous if you give it with something else, when in reality, it just doesn't have those interactions with other drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Global Cannabis March is taking place all over the world this Saturday. Look around for the location near you, and you'll be up there.
Sometimes it's a week late. In some cities, it's like a week late because of their situation. I think in France, they do it a little bit late. But, you know, yeah, it's basically this weekend and next weekend, mostly this weekend.
Excellent.
There's a huge march happening in Buenos Aires.
Dana Beal, we want to thank you for all you've done, all your activism, and for helping put together the march again this year. And good luck, and we hope you have some great weather.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. Subscribe now for free at mjagenda.com.
It's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
Hey, this is Willie Nelson, or Norman, and I smoke pot and I like it a lot. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer than alcohol. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting those who smoke marijuana responsibly. To learn what you can do to help, contact Normal at NORML.org or call toll-free 888-67-NORMAL.
The Marijuana Agenda. Like the liberal agenda, but with profits. Ka-ching.
I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 2 weeks for the voice of the industry from the National Cannabis Industry Association. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Just say no.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill.
That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to leave a state.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
Not so much of a rant today as just a bon voyage, because we're leaving Delta 9 Studios tomorrow for Fort Worth, Texas. We're headed to the Global Cannabis March, and there will be a live show. I know it's a travel day, but I'm taking a red-eye flight from Portland direct to Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and then tomorrow at 5 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Pacific, we'll be coming to you live from Texas with another edition of the Marijuana Agenda. So check it out. It's going to be a great march. I'll be down there speaking, as well as Lori Duckworth from the Southern Oregon Alternative Medicine. She was probably one of the last people busted for a felony for helping medical marijuana patients by running a dispensary just 10 days before dispensaries were made legal. So she's got a great story to tell. Also joining us there, I just found out this week, Coral Reefer, the activist, the social activist out there, the Instagram star from Santa Cruz, California. She's got her Stony Sunday and her News Nugs. She'll be coming out to Fort Worth, Texas to speak as well. I'm glad she's coming out. Being able to speak and march in the red states is a whole lot different, and it's you get this really cool vibe of everybody being together. It's really refreshing coming from the West Coast, where we've kind of balkanized into a whole bunch of separate little niches as far as medical and children and veterans, and you know, bless them all, we bring them all here on the Marijuana Agenda. But you get out there to the red states and you remember how for them there's no time to be separated. They're all one group fighting just to survive. So great to be out there in Texas. Big thanks to Sean McAllister and DFW Normal. You can check out their march at dfwnormal.org/march. And you'll be able to find out all the details if you'd like to join us out there. There's plenty of other speakers from Texas that'll be joining us. Some great folks that I've spoken with before, including a cop there who's an active duty police officer who's standing with us to stand for marijuana legalization. I got to meet him last year. He's amazing. Nick Novello, I think his name is. I could be wrong on that, but I think that's his name. He'll be out there, and he's a part of a new ad being run in Texas right now to gin up support for decriminalization in the state. So that's some great news. Great stuff coming out of Lone Star State. Well, that sound means that we're out of time here for our first podcast hour, but those of you watching and listening live on the Marijuana Agenda, stay tuned for Toker Talk Radio. Our phone lines will be open at 650-BEAGLE-MJ, and they will actually work this time. I know some of you tried to call in and couldn't get in. We're still working out some of the kinks here in the new studio. For everyone here at Delta 9, I'm Russ Belville. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, take care of each other, Tokers.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and SoundCloud. And follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
You think you're sweet, you're planning, you're growing, you're trying, you're rolling.